This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. National debates about problems in public education frequently focus on schools in major metropolitan areas. Our collective imagination has crystallized the image of overcrowded classrooms and decaying big city school buildings as the emblem of all that is wrong with our system of education. Somehow, we have forgotten that a third of all school-age children attend public school in rural areas. A new report by the Rural School and Community Trust says schools in tiny hamlets and small towns of less than 25,000 are not only overlooked, they may also be adversely affected by the latest education reforms. According to the report, the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind policy could place rural schools at a disadvantage when it comes to attracting the best teachers or meeting standardized test requirements. The report says 13 states from Mississippi to Maine have rural schools that are particularly vulnerable. Are we overlooking our rural schools? What problems are they facing, and how are their needs different from their urban counterparts? Should some rural districts be exempted from the latest federal mandates, or will such requirements help students in rural areas? Rural education is the talk of the nation. To join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Did you go to a rural school? Do you have children in one now? Call us and tell us your story. Joining us now is William Mathis. He's superintendent of the Rutland Northeast Supervisory School District in Vermont. He joins us by phone from the Neshobee Elementary School in Rutland, Vermont. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Mathis.
Certainly glad to be there.
I have to ask you, just for starters, how big a school is the Neshobee Elementary School? How many students do you have in that school?
Neshobee is about 350 students, and in the district we have schools ranging from 750 at the top down to 28 as the smallest.
And what's the range of students? What kinds of students do you have?
It's a K-12 district, and we have the whole range of students, as you might expect. It's a relatively homogeneous area, but it's socioeconomically diverse.
Take us inside your job. What's different about managing a rural school than, say, urban or suburban school? Give us a sense of that.
Well, in one sense, it's a whole lot more fun. It's a greater sense of community, a greater sense of belongingness. There's a sense of family about it, and that's really quite good. Some of the things that are more difficult are, as you had mentioned in the introduction, the adequate yearly progress kind of results are strictly a matter of statistical error when you may have a fourth grade with only one or two students in it. And so aggregating those things isn't exactly even scientifically feasible.
Maybe you can explain that to me a little bit more for people. You're saying that in a small school, for instance, when you have these standardized tests, if the class is very small and you've got one student who's brilliant, that could skew the results.
Definitely, and there's a strong body of research that shows that's true, is that when you start getting below, in our case in Vermont, is that if you have less than 170 students in the group being measured year-to-year gains, fourth grade this year to fourth grade next year, as they found in North Carolina, 70% of that difference in scores can be just random error and fluctuation on the test.
Now, school districts all over the country are feeling squeezed economically. How is your district feeling that, and how are you dealing with it?
Yes, we are being squeezed. Vermont is probably not as difficult as other areas. For example, there's about $59 billion shortage in state governments across the states, which gets pushed out to schools. And that's equivalent to the tax cut to the top 1% in the current administration proposal. And that's a significant amount of money. Where that hurts us, besides squeezing on the tax rate and squeezing on state aid, is where we see it the most is in facilities. And I think that's true for a lot of rural areas are just not able to keep up with the facilities needs that they have.
I'm curious. I understand that you went to school in an urban area. Is that right?
Yes.
How would you compare that experience now that you're in charge of a rural school district? How do you compare the two kinds of experiences, the rural versus the urban school experience?
I think that when I look at the pictures, when I went to school and saw 30 and 40 students in a classroom, and then now I'm superintending in a place where we have one licensed professional for every 10 students, the taxpayers support it and they want good schools. That makes a huge amount of difference. And the thing that really matters is when I sit down with my son to do homework. And the quality of the work that I'm seeing that the students are doing today is just simply remarkable. It's far better than and at a far higher level than what we had as students.
All right, I'd like to bring in another guest right now. Joining me here in Studio 3 is Rachel Tompkins, and she is president of the Rural School and Community Trust. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be here.
Well, we've just been listening to William Mathis describe his school district and describe the difference between a rural and urban school experience. First of all, how characteristic is what he's describing about his district of other rural school districts nationwide?
Well, one of the things, Lynn, that's certainly true is that there isn't a typical rural school district. I mean, if you look at the Black Belt of the South, around the Mississippi Delta, or you go to the Pueblos of New Mexico, or you go out on the plains to communities that are could be 100 miles apart, you have very, very diverse populations, some high poverty, some not so high poverty. The two things that are probably most characteristic of rural schools is they tend to be smaller than other schools, and they tend to be better connected to the community.
Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to many schools in West Virginia. My father was a country preacher. And I started off at home. My mother taught me the first grade at home. But then I went to the Minnehaha Springs Elementary School, which had one room. And then I went to the big city school in Marlinton, which has about 900 people in it. And that was a K through 6 school. And I finished my elementary years there in a two-room schoolhouse. My high school graduating class in Hinton, West Virginia, had less than 100.
So you clearly have an affection for the rural school experience.
I have an affection for rural places and rural schools, yes.
Why is it so important to protect rural schools, then, would you say?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of them. I think people have the sense that rural kind of dried up and blew away some time ago, or if it didn't last year, it will next year. And there are just large numbers of children going to rural schools. You mentioned a third in places under 25,000. In the really small places, which we emphasize in this report, places of 2,500 or less, 1 in 5 of our students are in those schools, and 30% of the schools are there. So to have a conversation about public education in America and not talk about rural schools is to ignore a big chunk of what's out there.
Well, the report that your organization put out, one of the premises of the report seems to be that rural schools aren't always focused on in the national debate. And it made me wonder, well, how is it possible that this large group has been overlooked, number one?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that, Lynn. I mean, we spend a lot of time sort of agonizing over it and talking about it. But one of the reasons is that rural people are a majority in only 4 states. Now, they're substantial minorities in another 20 states. But when you start talking politics or start talking making state policy and getting to 50% plus one in a state legislature, if you're in a minority, it's, you know, you've got to build coalitions. And so I think rural tends to get overlooked because those folks aren't a majority in many places. And then we have these stereotypes in the national view about what rural is. And they tend to either be on one end or the other of the spectrum. We call them the ain't it grand or ain't it awful stereotypes. Either it's all lovely out there, you know, it's nostalgic, wonderful, bucolic land, or it's awful, it's terrible, it's the most depressing places you've ever been. And both of those places exist in rural America and a lot in between. But people just don't have a very good fix on what the reality of rural places is.
Let's take a call. Lucinda in Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hello. Well, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I'm the president of a parent-teacher organization of a teeny rural school. We have 60 children in 4 classrooms, and our school right now is on the chopping block. Our school district is trying to solve their budget woes by cutting the last 2 rural schools in a what was formerly a dairy community that's, this is Wisconsin, so that's changing here now also. But consolidation is not the answer to the budget woes. The small rural schools are the absolute cheapest schools to operate, and the high cost is in the new buildings, which many of the small towns have built in the last 10 or 15 years, and the cost is in the administrators hired to run them. Our administrative office, the cost for that is, for 1 year, exceeds the cost of our of one of our teachers.
Okay, Lucinda, thanks for your call. Let's see if our guests can respond. Lucinda's raising the question of consolidation. First of all, William Mathis, is consolidation something that your district has looked into or Vermont is looking into? And that would be, I presume, maybe you can explain what consolidation is.
Yes, consolidation is constantly on the agenda, and I think it's on the agenda in other states besides Vermont. And people think that there's going to be a great economy of scale when we consolidate schools, and that's just really not true. We don't really save that much money by consolidating, and the gains that you would see are ephemeral. They're there for 1 year, and then they disappear. But I think one of the other things, and this also connects with the federal legislation too, is that we need to look at schools as something more than just simply producers of achievement test scores on somebody's accountability system. We're building citizens for a democracy, and we do know that there's good research that shows that children who go to small, rural, connected schools have it lessens the impacts of poverty. Your continuation rates are better in small rural schools, and it keeps a lot of people from taking a bad path in terms of their lives. And so when you start looking at it in a broader sense, consolidation is often trotted out there, is trotted out in every state, but it's just simply not an economic solution, nor is it a good educational solution.
Rachel Tompkins, the Rural School and Community Trust report on rural schools, focuses on the way the Bush administration's education reform might affect rural school districts, especially concerned about standardized testing. Why is that?
Well, in fact, this report is basically a reference report. It doesn't offer a particular critique, but the numbers tell a story that people then draw conclusions from. And the numbers from which they draw conclusions about No Child Left Behind are the indicator that shows that a majority of rural schools in America have less than 100 students per grade. And Bill Mathis cited some of the research on what kind of variation you get with small numbers. There's more and more studies are coming out in different states that indicate if you have less than 100 students per grade, you get a lot of wild swings in achievement test scores from 1 year to the next. So this notion that you're going to be able to have average yearly progress is probably not the case with those small numbers. What will happen is those schools will be labeled as schools in need of improvement based not upon what's going on with teaching and learning, but just on statistical fluctuations. That's the worry.
Yeah. And William Mathis, are you already feeling the effect of these reforms in your school district, and how are you handling them?
Well, yes. In fact, we've got one school that was just identified on the watch list. And then when we chart the variations that Rachel was talking about just a minute ago, we can just watch those scores bounce up and down. They are put on the watch list simply because they happened to pick the wrong year to start the process. If they started the year before, they would have shown great gains. And then we look at the kids that are going to be tested in the coming year, and we know it's going to go bouncing back the other way. And so what's really happening and what's really bad about this is that schools are labeled as failing schools when actually it's nothing more than random error. And also to emphasize what Rachel had said there before, we're seeing this data come out of North Carolina, a very large state with a lot of data. We're seeing that in Maine. We're seeing it in Massachusetts, where the medallion schools 1 year were the failing schools the next year. And we're seeing it in Vermont. It's just something that's particularly troublesome and prejudiced, if you will, against small and rural schools.
Well, thanks so much, William Mathis, for joining us.
Certainly.
William Mathis is the superintendent of the Rutland Northeast Supervisory School District in Vermont. Right now, we're talking about rural schools. My guest here in Studio 3A is Rachel Tompkins, president of the Rural School and Community Trust. And joining me now by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. is Eugene Hickok, undersecretary of the U.S. Department of of Education. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Hickok.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
First of all, Undersecretary Hickok, in developing the No Child Left Behind reforms, did the department take into account some of the special problems that are facing rural schools?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we did. A couple of things. One, it's impossible to write national education policy in a way that will, I guess, respond to the discrete interest of all the different organizations and sizes of schools. I think the law as written attempts to move in that direction because it provides a combination of money and flexibility in ways that haven't been there before. We are very cognizant as a department of the fact that rural schools, and I would argue not just rural schools, but remote schools in places like Alaska, for example, or Wyoming, have very, very unique challenges, not just under No Child Left Behind, but unique challenges generally. And one of our purposes with implementation of No Child Left Behind is to work with those folks to see if there are ways through this law and through other ways to help them meet those challenges. But it's a very, very tough piece of legislation, and it's a very, very complex education environment this country confronts.
Let me ask you about some of the concerns that have been raised here. I guess the most the biggest one is this concern with test scores, standardized testing, that in a very small school, in a very small classroom, one or two students can really skew the results. Do you see that as a problem? How do you deal with that in these reforms?
Well, first of all, it is a problem. But if you look at the law and if you look at the regulations, and now that we're getting some plans in from the various states, in essence, what we've told the states is simply this. The state has to look at the numbers it feels will be statistically significant enough to provide reliable, valid information on test scores. In some places where you've got a very small student population, you're just not going to be able to get those numbers high enough to be statistically significant. The other thing you want to protect, obviously, is student privacy and family privacy. So that is an issue, but it's an issue that the law allows room to address without overly regulating what's going on in rural schools.
Isn't part of the idea of No Child Left Behind that students at a school that is found to be inferior or not up to standards, that child can go to another school?
That certainly is one of the funding principles of No Child Left Behind.
I would imagine that would be much harder to implement in a rural area where there aren't many schools.
And that's where we have tried to talk about both the letter and the spirit of the law. For rural schools, for example, one thing to think about is the use of technology. The fact is, if a child's in a school that needs improvement in a location that's isolated, or not even isolated, but it would take a considerable distance to get to another school. We know that, practically speaking, public school choice to another public school is not an option. But choice is an option. You can create curriculum alternatives within the existing school. You can use charter schools. You can use technology. All of these are things to be thinking about, the sense of trying to be a combination of creativity, entrepreneurship, to live up with the school choice concerns of the law when actual choices are very limited.
Let me ask you about one other specific concern that's been raised before we go to a call, and that is the problem of attracting good teachers.
Yeah,
if a
sure.
school is identified as a low-achieving school, it might be harder to get good teachers. Again, I would think in a rural area, they probably have a harder time getting really good teachers to begin with because the population isn't there necessarily.
Well, certainly where the population isn't there, where the resources aren't there, where perhaps the salary isn't as high, you have a general market challenge with getting good teachers to begin with. And this law, by the way, has some pretty tough expectations on what we consider to be qualified teachers or highly qualified teachers. Having said that, some things to think about. Paraprofessionals, making sure that people leaving teacher preparation programs are prepared adequately for the unique challenges of rural schools. And frankly, our data tells us, while we have across the country a teacher retention challenge in that a lot of the newer teachers leave after 5 years, the ones that tend to stay longer tend to be in rural areas. And I think that's for two reasons. One, they find greater immediate satisfaction with the job and a connection with the families more so than in urban areas. And secondly, quality of life, frankly. So again, the challenge is there. I'm not sure that the answers are in any particular piece of public policy. I think the answers really are going to be the chemistry that can take place within a rural community to make sure they are attracting and keeping good teachers.
We're talking about rural schools. My guests are Eugene Hickok, he's the Undersecretary for the U.S. Department of Education, and Rachel Tompkins, President of the Rural School and Community Trust. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Janet in Kingstree, South Carolina. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead, Janet.
Yes, ma'am?
Yes, go ahead. Did you have a comment or a question?
Yes. The way they are handling the shortfall in our district, number one, we have to buy our own supplies, all our own supplies. We've been doing this for the past 2 years. We have not had a pay increase for the past 3 or 4 years. They are not hiring any substitutes. And next year, we are losing teachers. They said that we're going to increase class sizes, and we are losing teachers because they cannot afford to pay us.
Janet, you are a teacher, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And you teach in a small rural district? Or?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Mr. Hickok, would you want to respond to Janet?
Well, I tell you, I think if I heard what she said correctly, it sounds like the local school board is looking at the financial situation the board confronts and making these kinds of decisions. I can't pass judgment on the quality of the decisions. I can say this. I used to be a school board member in a relatively small town, and that's a tough job. It doesn't speak to the new law, as far as I can tell. I do think that the school board, and therefore Janet, might look at some of the flexibility in the new law to see if there might be some way to work with some of the issues she's talking about, but it sounds primarily like a local issue to me, as far as I can tell.
Rachel Tompkins, did you want to respond?
Yeah, Lynn, let me just say a word about state school financing systems. The bulk of funding for schools in America comes from state funds, and so No Child Left Behind comes into a context of how well states are already financing their schools. And in many states, and South Carolina is one, there are lawsuits that have been brought by rural districts regarding both the equity and the adequacy of the school financing systems in those states. In Arkansas and Tennessee, for example, recently, there are decisions that say that the gap in teacher salaries in those states is so large as to be inequitable and that the state legislature needs to address them. So there's both a money issue and a money issue being spent on the things that are most important, into which No Child Left Behind comes. And, of course, the federal level has not provided as much money as they had hoped to do so to implement No Child Left Behind. So states with budget shortfalls are being faced with higher standards, higher bars to be met, good ones, but without the resources at either the state level or new resources from the federal level to meet those new high standards.
If I could just real briefly piggyback on her comments, you're exactly right, Rachel. Most funding issues are state and local issues. And indeed, many states have gone through a combination of litigation and judicial decision-making on the nature of funding. I just spent some time with the governor of Arkansas. As you mentioned correctly, they're going through a tremendous challenge on meeting their court's determination on equity and adequacy. I guess I would take some issue with whether or not the No Child Left Behind is adequately funded. I mean, obviously, most people would argue that we always need more money in education. If you look at the amount of money being sent from Congress in Washington, it's record amounts. I think one of the challenges that we have, and I would have said this long before No Child Left Behind, one of the challenges we have is how we spend the money. That might be a tougher question to ask and have tougher responses in these days and times, but the fact is, as a country, we spend a lot of money. We could always spend more. But we really need to ask the tough question about whether we're spending it wisely. And that goes back to the caller's point. I don't know if those are the right decisions in that school district, but tough times demand good decisions. And that's something that this new law is all about, good information.
And Rachel Tompkins, before Eugene Hickok has to leave, I'm just wondering if you are satisfied with the answers he's given to some of the critiques that have been raised about the No Child Left Behind, particularly as they affect rural schools.
Yeah, I'm delighted to know that the department is looking at flexibility in terms of the implementation of the average yearly progress. A lot of schools have made a lot of proposals, and I really think they're going to need to look at the numbers, either state by state, that are required for that.
Oh, yeah.
For sure, technology is an opportunity on choice, but choice isn't a reality in rural places, and I'm pleased to see that the department recognizes that the notion of some alternative school isn't the right one. There's analysis in both Vermont and New Hampshire and some other states about the actual costs of meeting the high standards of No Child Left Behind. And it's some 3 to 5 times in both states, the analysis is 3 to 5 times what's being provided by the federal government. So while there is an increase, it's not enough to meet the high bar that's been set.
Mr. Hickok, I think the New Hampshire School Administrators Association estimated that the law would provide $77 per student, but actually add $575 in cost per student.
Yeah, we've seen the study. There was a study released last week that refutes every bit of that. In fact, it argues there's more than enough money, not just in New Hampshire, but certainly in New Hampshire, to implement the law. I looked at that study. In fact, I was up in New Hampshire a couple of weeks ago, and I just think it's seriously flawed. But that's not the issue. I mean, we're going to have points of view on these sorts of things. We are asking the right questions. We're going to debate how much money we spend and whether we spend it wisely. But it's a good debate to have. And I do think that one of the virtues of No Child Left Behind is that debate's taking place in school districts in South Carolina and across the country. And we will be a better place for that.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Hickok.
You bet.
Eugene Hickok is Undersecretary for the U.S. Department of Education. We're discussing rural schools on Talk of the Nation. The number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Tom in Carlisle, Iowa, I think it is. Tom?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I went to a school in Morning Sun, Iowa. Beautiful, beautiful name, but a very small town. A graduating class of 24 in 1972. And if I remember correctly, the total high school population was about 88. And what I remember about that experience was that there was a real richness to that kind of education, because not only did you get the basics, but you also, well, if you were going to have an athletic team, or if you're going to have a band, a marching band, or a concert band, or a choir, it really took everybody in the school to make that happen. And as a result, there was education that took place in the classroom, as well as a kind of education that took place outside the classroom. And as we are sharpening up our efforts to try to make sure that we leave no child behind, I hope that one of the things that we don't miss is that testing only tells a part of the story. And in fact, a lot of education takes place in and through school districts and in and through communities in a variety of ways that involve extracurricular stuff as well as what happens in the classroom.
Thanks for those points, Tom. Those are great points. Rachel, did you want to respond to
that? No, absolutely agree, and all the research that's been done supports that. We ought to do everything we can to hang on to small, community-connected schools.
Okay. Let's take another call. Amy in Pennsylvania. Hi, Amy. Amy?
Hi.
Go ahead.
I actually think that there is an alternative to rural schools. We live 7 miles from town, and we have chosen to homeschool our kids because we think that the standards at the public school are just too low. Our 6-year-old is really advanced in math, but only average in reading, so I'm tailoring his education to that. And then our 4-year-old is going to start kindergarten at home in the fall, and we have a special needs 3-year-old. So we kind of have all levels, and that just works better, I think, having them here rather than sending them away.
Okay, thanks for your call, Amy. I'm going to get Rachel Tompkins to respond. Rachel Tompkins is the president of the Rural School and Community Trust, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rachel?
Homeschooling was the option my mother took when I was in the first grade. She was a former school teacher. That's fine. The reality is it's not going to affect the large majority of children. We're going to have to deal with making our public schools better, not just talking about alternatives to them.
Here's an email from Brad in Salt Lake City, Utah. Here in Utah, there is considerable discussion of offering choice to students and parents by providing school vouchers to attend private schools. How do you think this will affect rural schools where choice really isn't an option? I think it will rob rural schools of funds that are already short. Rachel?
Yes, I think, again, this is something that it will play in different ways in different parts of the country. There are large sections of the South, for example, where 50 years ago, after Brown versus the Board of Education, white folks fled the schools, created private schools that still exist. The public schools in those areas, like in the Mississippi Delta, are largely all African American. Vouchers in that world will simply provide funding for people to go to those private schools and relieve them of the responsibility of paying for it. So it's a very complicated issue, but there's no way that vouchers, again, I'm back to the point I made earlier on homeschooling. None of these kinds of options are really going to deal with what we need to do in this country, which is make certain that public schools that 80 or more, 90% of children attend are better.
Okay, let's take one more call. Karen in Culver, Oregon. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was just going to make a comment. Several years ago, my husband and I were teaching in one-room schools in California. And what we noticed was that we had a number of children who they didn't stay very long because the parents were, like, in and out in the different jobs. But when they were in our school, all of them commented about how their children were getting, you know, felt much better about school and all because they were in small classes. Sometimes they were only one or two in a grade. And they were, you know, really happy, the children, because they had individual attention and they were, you know, they didn't feel like they were in the bottom of the heap and they received, you know, a lot of individual attention. And what I think is if you had smaller classes, you know, more teachers and less children and also longer school year, that the children would obviously learn a lot better.
Thanks for the call, Karen.
Thank you.
Rachel, just to conclude, Karen raises the point of this sense that we hear over and over again, the small school provides a sense of community, the small classrooms, and yet at the same time, the hard part of it is that perhaps they don't have the resources because the very things that provide the good thing can be the part that is hard for the rural schools.
Right. You know, prior to the telecommunications revolution, people worried a lot about being able to offer a rich curriculum in these small schools. That's no longer an issue. You can really offer a rich curriculum in these schools, and it doesn't have to be enormously expensive. The other thing is you don't save a lot of money closing small schools. People think you close a small school, okay, you get rid of two principals, and you only have one principal. You go back 5 years later, you find you got an assistant principal and a director of transportation, and you've increased transportation costs, and you haven't spent any more on instruction. So there's this notion somehow or the other that if we just make them bigger, they'll get better and we'll save money. Doesn't work. You end up spending a lot of money on transportation. And so our message to people is that there's a powerful pile of evidence that supports small schools. You listen to people talk that have called in about the values and the benefits they see for their children. We ought to try to figure out, we ought to use our imagination that the Secretary was talking about to try to figure out how to keep these small schools and finance them.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Rachel. Rachel Tompkins is the president of the Rural School and Community Trust.